Hey, what's up, Kyle? My name is Teddy Weiland. I'm calling in from Florida. Just wanted to say thanks for just all the podcasts that you've done. I've been listening to so many on the road, and just actually listened to the episode with Brendan Rue and Lindsay Locke. I believe it's episode 194. You guys were in the middle of it talking about beer and the side effects, and you actually mentioned it'd be so rad if you could go to a bar and they had kombucha and CBD type drinks. I believe it was like beer, non-alcoholic beer with THC in it. And that's actually what my family and I are doing, dude. We started a non-alcoholic pop-up bar called Off the Rocks, and we just did our first couple pop-ups in Florida. And yeah, man, we actually just put kombucha on the table at the last one, and we're mixing in zero proof liquors with it. And it's super cool. We just want to give that option that's not really there. And I was listening to that one and was just like, whoa, that's exactly what we're doing. So yeah, man, it was cool to hear about that. And just thanks for all that you're doing, the work you're doing with all your guests, and just putting information out there that isn't really talked about or really heard besides your podcast. So thanks, man. Thanks to all that you're doing, and have a good one. See ya.
Teddy Weiland, thank you so much for sending that voice memo in, my man. Glad to hear that you are doing some alt boozing out there in Florida. And if anyone is in Florida, they should go check out his pop-up, Off the Rocks. It's a very clever name. Happy to shine some light towards that business idea. And it's also very timely that I got this voice memo because I just finished my 1 year no beer. Had my first margarita about a week ago, and it was underwhelming. I'll leave it at that. I'm going to write a longer article about my year of taking a break from booze and everything that I learned from it on Substack in the weeks to come. So if you haven't already, you can go to tierman.substack.com and sign up for my newsletter. That's where I post all these podcasts, where I post all my articles. It's where you can comment, engage with me directly. And if you feel so inspired, if the spirit moves you, you can become a paid subscriber for just $6 a month. You can get content that is not available to the freebies. And it's also just a good way to support independent media if that's your thing. If you can't do that, just keep listening. Share the podcast with a friend. Maybe give it a rating on Apple Podcasts and keep being a good person. No pressure. And if you want to send a voice memo in, if you're a listener of this pod, if you've been listening for a while and you want to say, hey, what's up, everyone out there who's also listening, just bust out your phone, record less than a minute of audio. Let me know who you are, where you're listening from, maybe just some simple details about where it is that you are when you're recording in that moment. Maybe a book that you recommend, something simple. Non-promotional is always appreciated. And you can email it to tierman@substack.com. Pretty simple. And if it works, would love to play it at the beginning of this podcast. There's also a link in the description below to that email and everything else. This was a big podcast in the sense that it's really the first time that I'm talking about this book that I'm writing, which is tentatively titled How to Interview Your Parents and Why You Should Do It Now. I would say that I'm about 20% of the way through writing this book, and still very much in the research and gathering phase. I've written 4 chapters so far. And this was an interview that will very likely be used, at least excerpts will be used, for one of the chapters in the book. I would like to talk about the book intermittently whenever it makes sense, sort of give all of you a look under the kimono as I flail along on this new endeavor, This is my first book. Really excited about it. And the book idea came from an article that I wrote on Substack a while ago called How to Interview Your Dad and Why You Should Do It Now. Since then, a bunch of people have interviewed their parents, and I figured, you know, there's actually a lot more to the art of interviewing that I've never written about. But after 300 plus podcast episodes, it might be useful. So I hope that you all enjoy the book when it comes out. And again, you can follow along on this journey just by going to the Substack and sign up for the newsletter. This is a wonderful podcast. I was very happy with it. And it was with Katie Hendricks. Dr. Katie Hendricks is an evolutionary catalyst, contextual disruptor, and mentor who has been a pioneer in the field of body intelligence and conscious loving for 50 years. A previous guest on Oprah, Katie is the co-author of 12 books, including the best-selling Conscious Loving at the Speed of Life and Conscious Loving Ever After, How to Create a Thriving Relationship at Midlife and Beyond. She developed and led the unique leadership and transformation training for 30 years and is currently joining with her community through the Foundation for Conscious Living to create the Big Leap online program. These online videos are designed to support people in coming home to presence, restoring resourcefulness, and creating caring communities. Please welcome to the podcast, Dr. Katie Hendricks.
Kyle Salmon here. I'm in Cape Town.
I was the only journalist in northern Nigeria.
Not an adventure until you get lost in Tijuana.
You get caught inside by a giant wave, you feel really alone.
I love the adventure of waking up and not knowing what will happen and that being my job.
I'm standing at a desert oasis right now.
A lot of tourists don't see this part of Bali.
Smiles and thumbs up. Thumbs up.
Test, test, test. All right. And here we go. Thank you so much for welcoming me to your lovely home here, Katie.
Oh, you're so welcome, Kyle.
You said that you've been here for 22 years?
Uh-huh, 22 years. We came here right after 9/11. We were going to move to Maui, of all places. And then when 9/11 happened, our place here that we had sold fell out of escrow. And so we were looking, and then we couldn't sell it. And so we started looking at, well, maybe we're not supposed to move to Maui. And so we looked around and we decided to move over here. And even since the moment we decided to move here, everything has opened up in this most wonderful way. We created the Spiritual Cinema Circle, and we've written a whole bunch of books since we got over here. And but basically, we just love it here in Ojai.
Yeah. This is actually my first time here.
Well,
I know I've driven past Ventura about 1,001 times, but have never made it right back here
on
the other
side. Well, it is a little kind of protected valley. It was where the film Shangri-La was filmed many, many, many years ago. But it's a kind of a protected mountain valley. It's one of only four mountain valleys in the world that go east-west instead of north-south. So most mountain valleys, you only get sun for half a day, and then it gets kind of gloomy. Well, this we get sun all day long. And then at the end of the day, it throws the light in what's called the pink moment. It throws the light across the mountains, the Topatopas.
All right.
Yeah.
And Ojai's sort of known as a spiritual place. Like a lot of, I only know this vaguely, but
Well, Krishnamurti was here.
Right.
So okay. There have been various spiritual communities that have based themselves here over the last century. And they also bought up all the best property on the, around here. But it's been known as, it's a place of great natural peacefulness. And the Chumash, who were on this land before us, considered this whole valley a sacred place. So,
right.
Yeah, it has just a delicious feeling. If you look at it from up above, it looks a little bit like the south of France, or Italy. And we have a lot of agriculture here, a lot of citrus. But mostly it just has this beautiful serenity, and it's also known as a very creative place. People come here to really activate and to enjoy their creativity, and also because nobody really cares about your image. You know, you could go to the store in your pajamas and nobody cares.
Yeah.
And celebrities hang out here and nobody, you know, it's, you know, they can just be themselves. And so that's part of its specialness.
So were you in Ojai prior to buying this house 22 years ago?
No.
Okay, so you moved into Ojai then.
Yeah, moved into Ojai then.
Right. Yeah. One reason that I am excited to talk to you is that you have a very kind of vast timeline of watching the alternative relating movement grow since the 70s. And, you know, it seems that it has kind of morphed and shifted as culture has and grown in large part, I think, due to the failures of the conventional ways in which people were taught or not taught how to relate to each other. And the success that you've had in your writing and your work is largely people searching for a different way to do things.
I would say a different way to connect with others, but also a different way to experience life as a creative person rather than as just a function of the society, as another cog in the wheel. And one of the things I discovered just a few years ago were two terms that have really made a lot of difference to me. They're exogenous and endogenous. And exogenous means caused from without. Endogenous means caused within. From within. And the culture basically wants us to be good cogs so that society can function. I mean, our Western society, I think it's very different in Eastern societies because their focus is on the collective. And so the individual is much less important. But here in our society, we've made the individual more important than anything else, and including their effect on other people. So caused from without is where the rules and the making sure people like you and not doing the wrong thing and being shamed and all of those things that culture has used to kind of regulate people's behavior. But endogenous, caused from within, really means that people need to take responsibility for themselves. Like, here's what I'm doing. Here's what I said. Yes, I might have made a mistake. Oh, I need to take responsibility for that. Rather than having their lives controlled by other people criticizing and saying, if you keep doing that, we're going to, you know, and threats and the kinds of thing and laws. But all of that has gotten completely upended in the last 8 years. You know, everything that I grew up with has been upended. You know, all of the social norms. Like, for example, you can't shame people anymore to make them change their behavior. I mean, that used to be, you know, if you were shamed, well, in old society, that meant you would die because nobody would give you their attention. They wouldn't take care of you if you got hurt. So you'd be basically would be excluded. But now that's completely disappeared. And so the way that we both function together as individuals and our own fulfillment, but also how we connect with others and how we make society work is very much in question now. I mean, it's just a huge, huge issue.
Mm-hmm. One thing that I find is that we simultaneously we're more connected than ever, but we also have this ability, even just in relating with people who we know, to avoid more easily than ever. You can see this with dating where it's like, oh, I don't like you. We had a conflict. Okay, there's a million and one people on a dating app.
And,
right.
And just disappearing. Yeah.
And I think that similarly with our families too, it's really easy to more now than it was maybe 100 years ago or a couple hundred years ago. I mean, or even 10,000 years ago in tribal societies where you're really in a group.
You're in a group and that's your group. And we used to call those tribes.
Right.
And, you know, different tribes and they would have different fights with each other. But I actually want to question whether we are more connected now because we have more ways to connect, but my sense is that that connection is mostly what I would call horizontal. Like if you're sitting across from somebody, you know, waiting for a plane like I was, you know, everybody's on their devices. We're all connected, but nobody's connected.
Right.
At the level of actually a felt connection, of giving and receiving attention. And that's one of the things that I've put a great deal of focus on in the last few years, because most people don't realize that attention is as much a nutrient as food or water. If we don't get attention, and we've known this for about 100 years now with research, is that when humans don't get attention, they wither up. They actually can die. But even if they don't die outright, their sense of spirit and, you know, and being alive and enjoying the flow of life and connection withers. And so we've learned, I think people have learned, especially in their families, to take on whatever role is going to give them at least some attention. And we get that attention connected with love. So like in my family, my brother was always known, my older brother was always known as number one. And so my mother would call and say, "Oh, I just talked to number one." And so that, it was like some of the party hats had already been taken. And so I developed what I called an Avis persona. I'm number two, I try harder. And so I was super responsible and I would look out for things because that gave me at least some attention. It wasn't as fun as just getting attention for being me, but I got at least some attention. And I think everybody has some kind of a recipe for what do I need to do to get attention. And we call that connection. But I really question whether there's much nourishment in the kind of flipping past a picture or giving a like. That's not attention. Attention is really turning toward another person, experiencing your breathing together, feeling what's going on in your body, having some sense of what they're experiencing. That's where connection goes deep rather than just this horizontal, how high are you, fine, kind of thing that we're taught and that I was taught growing up too.
Yeah, it makes me think of an analogy of like a sugar diet that makes you feel really high, but
for
then,
a minute,
for a minute, and yeah. then dissolves on then, your tongue 10 seconds later.
Right, and can also bring a big downer.
Right.
The other thing that what you were saying was just reminding me of is that our culture runs on adrenaline. And it has for quite a long time. So when I was growing up, and my dad made the first, he built the first television in our whole neighborhood. So back in the 1950s, and we used to have people who would come and sit on our front lawn to watch television through our living room because we had the only television. So from that time to now, we've had so much of both content, but also the not so much of a sense of deep connection that allows people to co-create with each other, to experience life as we're all in it together, rather than we're in it, you know, in separate tribes, and then the tribes don't have anything to do with each other. Back then, I could disappear all day long and nobody cared. They would just say, you know, come back before dark. So we had a different kind of adventure together. We could go off and create adventures. But the pace of life was slower than it is now. It's gotten speedier and speedier and speedier. And when we first started watching television or movies, if a car backfired or one gun went off, it was like, oh, it was totally shocking and everybody would be, oh my goodness, you know. But now, if you're not blowing up several universes, you don't get that same hit of adrenaline. And I think that's actually one of the biggest problems going on right now is because adrenaline is a short-acting non-creative drug. In other words, you get that big hit that you're talking about, and then it drains off, like the sugar hit. And so you have to escalate the adrenaline you get habituated to it. So you have to get it more and more and more adrenaline. And I think that's one of the big things that we're seeing now, because then it all leads to us versus them. and you got to say more bad things about the other person to get that adrenaline, or blame and criticism in relationships to get that same hit of adrenaline. But it drains off very quickly.
Yeah, I think that it's also really hard to do any kind of big picture thinking when you're in that mental state. And you hear the story more and more from people who worked some super intense job for 10 years and they remember almost nothing from it.
Right.
And they're like, how did I get here?
Yeah, because they're just...
Right.
And you can see that in some of the depictions of how people are, young people are functioning in organizations and what it takes for them to be kind of on the current treadmill, and the sacrifice of not only their own sort of their own well-being or their own sense of themselves, but also getting genuine connection with other people. And that's, I think, why we have so much addiction, because genuine connection is the antidote to addiction. Not more addiction, but that's what we're getting, is just more, you know, more and more and more escalation. So a lot of our work has really been about people receiving the nutrient of other people's attention, being able to give and receive, and what it takes to be able to do that. Because mostly people are like out in front of themselves. They're so speedy that they don't even notice that they lost connection.
Yeah.
And I experienced that as kind of a, we used to think of it as primarily in LA, a kind of experience, because you'd greet somebody, but they're looking over your shoulder to see if there's somebody more important to look at. And so there's not really that sense of, ah, here we are together. And that kind of connection is, I think, is part of the partly responsible for how much chaos is going on right now, because when, and because adrenaline is another expression of fear. And when people are in fear, two things happen. One, they get stupid. So you can't use your problem-solving brain. You go back reptilian and wah. And the other is that other people become the enemy. So if I'm in adrenaline, you're like, I don't have to trust you. I don't, and it comes in a part of the brain that we can't really even, we're not aware of, that sense of whether you're a friend or foe. But it's one of the first sorts that the brain does, friend or foe. But in fear, you're a foe. And that means I can do anything.
Right.
You know, I can disparage you, I can lie about you, I can threaten you, because you're not like me.
Right. So many places that we can go. And I know that we're going to get into, talking about parent-child relationships here, which I'm really looking forward to. And I think that this conversation of attention can kind of, harken back there.
Yeah.
One thing that I see as being a really, relevant cultural conversation among young people, a relevant anxiety, maybe it's just me, but but I wanted to get your answer on how you might talk through someone who has a fear of irrelevance. I think that in this kind of attention seeking, more, faster economy, media cycle, and the highs and lows that come with attention, and I would say that most people, it doesn't even so much come as like rejection, but just feeling like they don't matter, like a lack of response and a need for a response to verify that their life matters on some deep level.
Yeah.
And I think that this conversation is just getting bigger and bigger with AI coming out and everyone kind of terrified that they are, these skills that they've worked to develop are irrelevant.
And they may be.
Right. And they may be. But it tends to then feel like it's a, you know, like a kind of clamoring for attention and validation in a way that is just looking for more of a sugar rush. And I think that it's about... I want to get, how would you kind of handle starting that conversation with someone, a younger person who has that kind of fear of irrelevance in today's adrenaline-filled world?
Well, one thing that people don't realize, when I was born there were 3 billion people on the planet. They're now between 8 and 9 billion. So there are a huge number of people, more than back when there seemed to be space for everybody. And so I think one of the things people are experiencing is the pressure of so many people. How am I going to stand out? I mean, there's so many people. What's different or important about me? And one thing I've noticed over the years is that everybody wants to belong and everybody wants to be able to make a difference, you know, to make a difference in the world, to make some kind of a contribution in the world. But what we tend to do is to look at what's available, what's the menu, and to try and pick from that. And I think what's being called for now is a worldwide entrepreneurial revolution where people really come at the world from what we call genius, something that I love to do that makes time disappear when I'm doing it, but also contributes. And I think getting both ends of those is the challenge. So first, to find out what is it that I most love to do, and that and it could be something you don't think is going to be able to really make a difference or have an impact on the world or even make you money. Like, I love to move. And Gay loved to sit in his living room and talk to people.
Right. That's your husband, what he, yes.
That my husband Gay Hendricks, yeah. Loved to do that. And so finding out what is your genius, and then how can you use that to contribute in the world. And I, for example, have been an entrepreneur. I had one job as a young person, and I have been working for myself since 1975. So I have some experience in the world of how can I create something that's relevant, but that's also going to serve me and make money and be able to have a home and so on. And to me, I think that's the pathway for people. Because if you look out there, it's pretty much dried up. And what it's based on is how can I make more money? And rather than how can I create more meaningful connection and creative collaboration, you know, creating together, collaborating together is one of the great joys on the planet. But if you're playing with that, I'm working for my boss and my boss has power over me, that power over has its own limitations of if I have power over you, you're going to tend to hide things from me and not really share or say, no, I don't like what you just said, or I disagree with that. So creating a culture of entrepreneurial is a co-creation where it's more of a flattened hierarchy than it is a traditional hierarchy. But we've been in the traditional hierarchy and people are trying to drag us back into it now, of, you know, bringing people back to work now, you can't work from home, and all of those different things that are happening for people. I think we're in a very chaotic time that's going to continue for some years.
So one thing I know is that you do advocate for creativity all over your site. Yeah. which might seem confusing for people, because they're maybe going up and checking you out knowing you and Gay as the relationship people.
Yes.
But whether it's creativity as a vocation or as a hobby, it seems like you're placing a lot of emphasis on that as a really important thing for a human life that can,
yes,
that can kind of have tertiary benefits to all these other aspects,
yeah,
of your life.
It's really like the river.
Right.
And in some ways, it's really the ocean,
right,
that the rivers feed into. That creativity, that basic juiciness, is your life energy. And the more that you're opening your creativity, the more that you're opening your feelings, you're being able to understand other people. And your creative spark comes out of the same pipe, you know, as all of your feelings. And so we emphasize creativity because it's really your life force. Everything else comes from that. And so when people say, oh, I'm not creative, we are in fact creating all the time, but mostly we're creating unconsciously. We're just recreating the patterns that we learned rather than truly creating, really responding from an inner impulse of like, oh, I like, I mean, the basic one is yes, I really like this. No, I don't like this. And that whole, what I call a whole body yes, really allows your all of your systems to turn on rather than you're, you know, like working with two spark plugs, you know, out of your 8 or 16, depending how big your car is. But we have an all electric one now, so we've eliminated all of that stuff.
Right. I have a friend who is a former editor of mine, really talented writer, and I had a phone conversation with her recently. I asked her what she was up to, and she's like, this might sound really off-brand for me, but I'm getting into throwing footballs around, and I just love it. And I don't know what it is, but I'm just hucking these footballs, and like, you know, she's
using her body.
She's got kids. Yeah. She's in her mid-30s. Mm-hmm. She, like, not something that you would expect,
right,
but it's just a thing for her that she is deriving intense joy from.
Yes, that's really wonderful. So that whole body engagement, you know, we're known for our relationship work, but we also wrote a book called At the Speed of Life, among our other books.
It's a great title.
Which is, yes, yes. I was very proud of it, which is about body intelligence. It's really about using your breath and your movement and your communication and your ability to play to enhance your experience of being alive, but then also to generate solutions to problems, to create more fulfilling relationships of all kinds. So they really work together. So creativity, body intelligence, and relationships, all of our lives are about relationships. We are in relationship from the moment we're born until the moment we die. But most of it's unconscious.
If someone was listening to this and they thought, well, I'm in a job that I don't particularly like, but I need to keep it because it's the way that I pay my bills.
Right.
I have lost touch with my creativity.
Yeah.
Don't particularly fancy myself as a creative person.
And you may be even scared that you're not creative, or is creativity even important anyway?
Or that you'll fail if you try.
Right.
What would you recommend as the first steps for someone like this? To just start and sustain something?
I think that declaring that you actually want to open up to your creativity. So that would be what we call a commitment. So in order to discover something, you first need to want to. So rather than waiting for it to come to you, which is what our society is about, we just have to click a remote and it comes to us. But your creativity is a whole body involvement. I think of it as akin to if you want to swim and you're on the edge of the pool. You can have all kinds of opinions about swimming and who's in the pool and how cold it is and you're going to sink. But if you want to learn to swim, the first thing you got to do is get in the pool. And so the commitment is, and you don't know how. See, that's the thing. We think, well, give me a guarantee that if I do this, you know, I'm not going to starve to death, you know, in week three. But the commitment gets you into the game. And then recommitting is what gets you from where you are to where you want to go. So you get in the game, you get in the pool, and then you get to find out what you need to learn. Because you may find out that you float. Hey, I don't really need, I can just paddle around, it's no big deal. Or you might find that you sink. You might find that you're one of those lean body people who goes right to the bottom of the pool. So you might want to start out in the shallow end, you know, of going out a little bit and playing with the unknown and then coming back to home base. So what's one thing today that you could do differently than you did yesterday? It could be even something as the way you go to work. You know, the route you go to work, what you eat for breakfast, how you brush your teeth. So if you change one habitual pattern, that begins to awaken your creativity. So you're not just, you know, on a gerbil wheel.
All right. That's great advice. Another thing that I wanted to ask you about is appreciation. One thing that struck me on your website was that you said appreciation is the highest ROI that we can get in relating to each other.
Yep.
Why?
One, the biggest killer for relationships of all kinds, not just romantic relationships, but parent-child relationships, is blame and criticism. And it is the most common interaction in most relationships. Because I remember hearing, like, Katie, I'm just telling you this for your own good, and I just knew I was going to be criticized. And so even as I'm saying it, I can feel myself sort of cringing a little bit and withdrawing. So I wasn't going to let that in. So blame and criticism is what we've been taught. If you really cared for people, you'd tell them what they were doing. You're not going to wear that, are you? And all, you know, all that kind of stuff. But appreciation is a genuine contact. So when we're talking about giving and receiving attention, appreciation is the most powerful kind of attention you can give. And it's not just, oh, really appreciated that, because we hear that all the time. It is giving your sensitive awareness to someone else so that you really are kind of feeling into them. You may not say that, but you're giving your attention in that generous way. And you're noticing something that's working, not something that's not working. So like an appreciation might be, you know, I was really noticing how compact you were able to organize all of your equipment to bring. So just bringing it in a backpack. And it, I imagine that just makes things just much more mobile and easy for you. So that's not a profound appreciation, but it's an accurate one. So I'm giving my attention, I'm noticing something that's real, and I'm sharing that I notice that that makes a difference. And your brain, your emotional brain, is going to register that. And so it could be traits. It could be, oh gosh, you smell great. It could be, you know, I noticed, oh, you got a haircut, and you know, it really suits you. So it could be that kind of thing. But what actually even works much more deeply is, oh yeah, I just noticed that sigh. Yeah. So that I'm available for a deeper connection of like, what's going on? How are you experiencing this? So it's experiencing other people as evolving works of art, not your own personal improvement projects. Mm-hmm. And I know for a lot of parents and children, the parents think that they're supposed to be, you know, their kids are their improvement project. You know, we're going to get you into shape so you're ready to go into society, rather than, oh, what really interests you? How can I support you developing that thing that you just would like to do all day long? And then that's where your entrepreneurs come from, from appreciation. So the other thing about appreciation is there's no downside. And what I've experienced with the thousands of people I've worked with is that appreciation fills the emotional reservoir. And when, so you can draw on it when there are strains or, you know, things are more tense or more chaotic, you can draw on that sense of, ah, we're in this together. I know that you receive me as a valuable human being. That's what appreciation does.
It's also so immediate.
Yeah.
Right?
It's right now.
Yeah, it's
and
not
like... And you
can
tell if it worked.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's big stuff like, okay, we're going to plan a trip together.
Right. Or,
but I think that when it comes to relating, in couples, the stuff that feels like it's going to move the needle on the relationship can feel like so much work.
Yes.
And it's so far out there that you kind of just keep pushing it off,
right?
Because it's too big to even start, right? It's like saying, like, hey, I want you to start being creative. Why don't you make a feature film,
right?
I'm like, that probably isn't the best way.
Got some time next week?
Exactly. Right. And I wanted to underscore what you said about the specificity. Also, thank you. I do keep all of my podcast gear in a single backpack.
I know. It's very impressive.
Works as a carry-on on any plane.
Exactly.
I think that the specificity can often make people feel more seen than profundity, because profundity is often so obtuse.
Well, that and it's abstract.
And like, abstract,
you know,
yeah.
And even if I'm saying, oh, how are you today? It's, no, that's very... you know, that could be just taken off a ticker tape, or, you know, an AI could definitely go, how you doing?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It actually makes me think my girlfriend is, she's really good at this, and she does it this with not just me, but a lot of people. And, a few weeks ago, she met a girl who had kind of a bump on her nose, and it gave her a nose with character. And she said, I really like the way your nose looks. And I thought the girl was going to start crying. Like, it was just something that she had carried with her.
Well, that she probably also had tried to hide.
Right.
So I think a lot of what's underlying that, let's put it off, is that most relationships are not based on honesty, transparency, authenticity. They're based on secrets of one sort or another. And so if you start, you know, like opening the faucet, that's going to come out. Mm. And so people just keep running ahead of that because they don't want to actually tell the truth about something they've been hiding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I just to continue to linger on the appreciation thing,
please.
Because it is, I think, really smart in the way that, like, the reservoir could always use more water. And I think that a lot of people, whether it's a parent-child dynamic or a couple's dynamic, they tend to start focusing on fixing the problems.
Exactly.
Very directly.
Yes.
And it's kind of like it's like being on a mountain bike ride and seeing a big tree in front of you and being like, I don't want to hit this tree. And you're looking directly at the
right,
tree
rather than taking action.
Yeah. Yes. It, on a mountain bike ride, or snowboarding, you look where you want to go.
Right.
And if you see a tree, you actually look to the left of the tree or the right of the tree
to pick the path you want to go.
And I see that as appreciation.
Yes. Yeah. That's a great way of looking at it. I wanted to mention that we think that appreciation is so important. We have appreciation menus. So we have for people, because how many people are actually taught how to give an effective appreciation? And, you know, we feel awkward or clumsy, and so we just don't do it. And so we have parent-child appreciation menus. But one of the places where people don't give appreciation is to themselves. So they expect, well, if I give it to you, then you're going to give it to me. And then you can't always count on that. And so on our foundation website, we have two websites, hendrix.com and foundationforconsciousliving.org. And on that, if you sign up on the foundation website, if you sign up for a newsletter, you're going to get 66 days of a little suggestion for appreciating yourself for that day. And because we now know that it takes at least 66 days to create a new habit. And I want people to get into the habit of appreciating themselves richly, because I notice that when people appreciate themselves, that spills over. Their reservoir is filled, and the overflow spills out to other people. Other people can see it and feel it, and they become then a beacon of appreciation rather than a consumer of appreciation.
Well, I'll certainly link to the newsletter and encourage people to sign up there. Is there an appreciation that you would recommend people start with right now? Like I said, what would one of those prompts look like?
Okay. I appreciate myself for giving myself curious attention. Because mostly we give ourselves what's wrong attention. Okay, what's wrong now? You know, either like if I say to somebody, notice something going on in you, and almost always people will notice something that's wrong. And we're wired up for that, you know, because to protect ourselves. So through evolution, we've wanted to understand and see very quickly what's wrong. But that doesn't work anymore, you know, in our civilization. And so tuning yourself up to shift from criticism to curiosity is a really important first move. And you can do that because you can generate curiosity. So how I have people do this, it's very simple. It's a body hack. It's to go, through a whole out-breath, because the is what we're used to, the what are you up to, you know, of the criticism. But a you cannot criticize yourself while you're humming. And so try it. You can't do it.
Hmm. I feel like we should just do this for the rest of the podcast, because that felt so good.
And little kids do it when they're problem solving. They're generating. And so if you give that to yourself, so again, the first prompt that I would say is, I appreciate myself, or you can even start with, I appreciate myself for giving me some curious attention. Curious attention. And so that, and then if you find yourself criticizing, I'm going to just appreciate that I'm noticing I just got critical. And then you're shifting again. Or just, I'm appreciating that I hmmed again. Rather than,
Right. The last thing that I wanted to ask you about more generally before we get specifically into parent stuff is tone of voice.
What?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you have a terrifying tone of voice. I've been wanting to run out the door this entire time.
I've been noticing that.
Yes. But I tone comes through more than... I think that it's a greater... It's a... How do I put this? Like, we articulate ourselves better through tone than words.
Most of our communication is nonverbal.
Right.
So only 7% is the words, the actual content. The rest of it is how you're using your body, but a lot of it is tonality.
Right.
And I think it's like something like 67%. So when people are trying to change a habit and they simply change the words,
right?
Okay,
yeah, exactly.
I'll appreciate you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I love you.
Yeah.
So one thing that I find is that when I get mad, it's impossible for me to change my tone.
Yeah.
It feels physically impossible for me to not have...
You're not alone in that.
I can go from, you know, maybe I can step back from rage to annoyance, but that's about as far as I'll get.
That's very common for almost everybody. In fact, one of the suggestions that I make for partners of all kinds is that when you get into hassle, drop the words out and continue your conversation with sounds and gestures. And right, exactly, yeah. Almost right away it gets fun. You realize that partners can find just the tonality that's going to poke you. And that all happens a lot unconsciously. But if people shift, drop the words out, and really focus on just playing with sounds and gestures, they begin to expand their tone vocabulary. I wanted to share a short thing with my mother. This was back before cell phones, when I was away on a trip. This is when I lived in Colorado, and the phone rings, and you know, also you can't tell who's calling. So I pick up the phone, and rather than any identification, the voice says, "Oh, so you're home." And that tonality was what I grew up with. It was my mother. Instead of saying, "Hi, gosh, where have you been?" or "What do you know?" she said, "Oh, you're home." And all of the implications of how come you haven't called me? I always have to call you. So the criticism and all that comes through the tonality, and we pick it up. You know, we're like little Velcro. You know, if there's something in there, we're going to just scoop it right up.
And tone Velcro.
Yeah, tone Velcro. And so unhooking yourself from that is probably the first thing. Don't try to change it. Just unhook it. Right. You know, we actually ask people if they would like to create their relationship as a blame-free zone. And for both of them to commit to that, so that as they're practicing, because you're not going to do it, it's the mountain. You're not going to do it perfectly. You're going to be awkward at first. But if you're both interested and you both commit and then you recommit, like, oh man, really screwed that one up. Let me come out that. One of our friends calls it a do-over. And they actually will go out there. Oh, I'm doing a do-over. Go out the door and come back in again. So you get more creative, more inventive. But you really then establish, we're in this together. We're creating something new together rather than that same old, you know, what we really call the drama triangle, which is the hero, victim, villain. So it's either, oh, poor me, poor you, or screw you.
Right, right. I love the idea of getting into a fight with, or trying to solve a fight or express your feelings without words.
It is so much fun. If right. I've seen a whole room doing this, and it, like in 2 seconds, it gets funny.
Yeah.
Because if one of the things that does drop out in drama is your sense of humor, and that sense of, you know, we're all humans, and you know, we make mistakes, but it's funny.
Right.
And so I ask people sometimes, is it funny yet? And they go, what do you mean we have a problem to solve? It's not funny. It's only going to be funny if you admit that you're wrong. And so you get into this, you know, this one up, one down power struggle. But when you let your body be included, your whole body intelligence, your whole body creativity, you can invent. I mean, we've invented all kinds of things to assist people to see the other as an ally, you know, on the same team rather than, you know, I'm going to be in charge here.
Yeah. I might be misremembering this, but I think that the Gottman ratio is...
It's 5-1.
Right. So it's all... He could predict with relative accuracy whether or not a couple would be together 5 years later
yep.
by watching how they fought.
Yep.
And the key factor was if one of them would make a joke, if they could laugh. And in doing that,
yep.
humor is really the willingness to step outside of this plane of yep. reality and tilt it a little bit
yep.
in a way that allows you to see it more clearly. That I think that comedy,
all of the great comics do. I'm thinking particularly yeah. of George Carlin and Robin Williams.
Yeah.
were brilliant at that lateral move. You know, just you know, to, and also Monty Python.
Yeah.
You know, which I consider the high watermark of Western civilization. That just shows you my age. But when they came in, they made. I mean, if you really look at what they did, they went after everything in society.
Yeah.
You know, and all of their films are really about getting out of exogenous world of, you know, everybody's a cookie cutter and stepping out of that into a new kind of reality that you create.
Right.
And that's a large part by humor. One of the things I've noticed on social media lately is that most people have totally lost their sense of humor. Like we had a post that I used to consider really, really funny. It was by Louis Grizzard. He said, you know, I'm not going to get married again. I'm just going to find a woman I don't like and give her a house. Which I thought was hilarious. And people just went out. Yeah. We had like a huge number of comments like, this is just unacceptable.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, so they didn't get, you know, that
yeah.
funny.
I was planning on asking you this later in the interview, but maybe it's a good time to jump in right now, which is since this, let's say, alternative thinking movement, which, you know, really, let's say...
We used to call it the New Age.
The New Age, you know, let's start with Esalen Institute and
yes.
everything that was going on there with
yes.
the human potential movement
yes.
and questioning the status quo. And you know, I think that a lot of those ideas really like thrust themselves onto California culture and American culture back then. And
yes.
over the past 60 years or so, we've gained, I think, a lot of literacy and new terms with psychology. It's a lot less taboo to
yeah.
have a therapist now,
yeah.
things like that. Less taboo. A lot of young people seeking out people, like folks like yourself.
Yeah, mentors.
Mentors.
Yeah.
And with that, I have found just truckloads of... charlatans and
yeah.
People who maybe even believe their own bullshit, but call themselves teachers and preach the good gospel, but are so hypocritical in
yeah.
the way that they interact with others.
Yes.
People who talk about ego death, but are egomaniacs.
Yes.
And
you mean hypocrisy.
Yes. And I want to get your... I think the way into this is humor, because really one of the reasons that I was excited to talk with you and trust your perspective is that you're laughing a lot in a lot of the videos that you
true.
That you put out. And I think that that's, yeah, well, look at this. I want to spend the rest of my life laughing with you is a sign we have in the side of this room here. But it's real. It's a real way that I navigate whether or not someone is worth listening to.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. One of the things that people have said about Gay and Me is they always know where we are because that's where the laughter is coming from. Now, and before I met Gay, I didn't laugh very much. I was very serious. I've gotten a lot funnier and enjoying humor a lot more than I was even as a kid. And I think that what you're pointing to is what we call integrity. And we have a whole development. In fact, I can share some more of this with you later. But integrity is really being, the definition of integrity is a totality or wholeness with nothing lacking. And it's really about alignment with reality. It's not about morality and good and bad. It's really about, am I aligned with the way life is going, or if I put up barriers, or I'm actually pushing against the way that life works? And so we developed several decades ago, something called the four pillars of integrity, which are about emotional transparency, impeccable agreements, healthy responsibility, and conscious communication. And we have doable, and they're all doable skills. It's not woo-woo. That's the other thing, is that people will say, oh, I want you to, like someone will say with regard to fear, well, just don't be scared. There's nothing to be scared of. And that completely ignores your whole physiology and everything that's going, ah, I've got to get out of here. So when you're aligned with reality, you enter into what we call ease and flow. And being in the right place at the right time. Like, for example, I was in Chicago last week, and I was about to fly back here. And so there was a storm coming in, and I was in line to get on the plane, and we were delayed for about 20 minutes, but we were able to get on the plane. And I could just feel, you know, there were 30,000 flights that had been canceled around us. We got on that plane and flew out, and the storm came in and then flooded Chicago. So being in the right place at the right time so that life works more easily and not so effortfully is really one of the benefits of being in integrity. And I started even as a kid, and that was what, you know, we, you know, I participated in the anti-war movement, you know, back with Vietnam was our war, and we were able to get Nixon out of office because of their hypocrisy and bringing absolute attention to the, you know, they're saying this, but you know they're doing this. And now we know, of course, that there are all of these lies about, and there are always lies around war.
If you met someone who you felt was being hypocritical, mm-hmm. let's say that they were in their 30s, they had started talking about psychedelics and self-love and conscious relating, and they'd maybe gained a big Instagram following, and people were starting to hire them to be their coach, but you sensed a real deep hypocrisy mm-hmm. in what they were teaching versus the way that they were living their life.
Yeah.
How would you go about opening up a conversation?
Well, I probably wouldn't, because they wouldn't be the kind of person who would approach me. But if I were in conversation with and something hypocritical came out of their mouth, what I've learned to do is to say something unarguable in response to that. And it's usually like, oh, when you said that, I could just feel this heat rushing into my cheeks. And I had the thought, oh, we discredited that one about 2 decades ago. So I would report something that was actually happening, but I would interrupt the flow of la 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 la.
Right. Yeah, I think that there's a culture of politeness.
Exactly.
In the healing community. And uh-huh. there's
a lot of niceness.
A lot of people not wanting to confront.
Yeah.
It's a lot of talking about confronting our feelings, right. but not being willing to have an uncomfortable confrontation with someone.
Yeah, we call it, you know, the sweaty 10-minute conversation.
Right.
And so a lot of, you know, we train people how to do that. We train trainers how to teach other people how to do that. And part of that is really being willing to have other people be uncomfortable in your presence and being able to identify what you're actually experiencing and speak from that. Because most people speak in like, well, I think that's wrong. You know, my stats say that, and you know, you just get into this ping pong of blame. But if I go, oh, whew, I just felt my breath hold and I realized I got scared when I heard that. That interrupts the hypocrisy. And it also allows you or me to come back home to myself. So I'm located, I know where I am, I'm present. So a lot of, I have some stories about being with hypocrites, which I'll tell you, you know, I can tell you off camera. But when someone is confronted, I really notice the way they respond to that. And so the people that I really respect will say, I didn't realize that tone. Or like oh, I've, you know, I just felt like you just hit me with something. And if they respond to that with, oh, and they get present and they actually relate to me, then there's a possibility that we can have a conversation.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I think that it's important not to demonize people. You know, we're all on our own journey and everyone's just looking for love. And I think that
some people are looking for trouble.
Maybe some people are looking for trouble, but I think that there are a lot of people, let's just say specifically in the psychedelic community, who try psychedelics, think they see God, believe that they should be teachers and spreading the good gospel,
right,
without any real knowledge of psychology,
yes,
or the mind. And are very irresponsible and kind of cavalier in the way
that they... I think that's true. And I think that we're... I think this is a caveat emptor. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a buyer beware
right.
problem. That I think we need to be smarter. You know, if you're shopping, like, I want to know, okay, where did you learn this? How much experience do you have? What have been the results of the people you've worked with? How are they doing? I want some context, and that people actually have some experience. So we have been involved with and known about psychedelic research, you know, back in the 80s. And then, you know, it got put on Schedule A and all went underground. But we've known about the power of the psychedelic for healing of all kinds, particularly PTSD, for a very long time. So I'm, on the one hand, I'm very glad that that's been come, that we're now allowed to do more research. But when 13,000 people show up for a psychedelic conference, you know that it's not all about, you know, people, you know, getting aligned and having a better life.
Right.
So, you know, it may just be our new addiction. So, you know, that I have also realized that I don't want to be people's policeman, you know, because then I just get into, we got the good guys and the bad guys. So I want to teach people how they can genuinely respond to life in a different way rather than the reactivity that comes from fear. So I've done a lot of work on how people can befriend fear. In fact, I have a whole section on the website because I think at the bottom of every problem is that people haven't befriended fear and they're in the fear trance. Mm. And from that, everybody's the enemy. You can't think. Around we go.
Right. Let's talk about parents.
Yes. Of which I am one.
which you are one.
And a grandparent as well.
Have your kids ever interviewed you?
No. In fact, well, actually, no, that's not true. Back, my kids have interviewed me.
They have.
I have one kid.
Okay.
Yeah, and Gay has one kid, so we have two together.
If someone were to pick up the book that I'm writing and think, you know, I want to do this. I want to interview my parents. What are some things that you might recommend they consider before doing it? As I mentioned before we went on air, I feel comfortable providing advice on how to interview, mm-hmm. but I only have my experience with my parents.
Yeah.
We all have a different relationship, and I think that you have a far vaster experience with people who have had such a wide range mm-hmm. of relationship with parents. Is there anything that you might recommend they do before taking this on? Any questions they might ask themselves or
pre-interview? Not that they would be asking their parents, but they would be asking themselves.
Things that they could ask themselves to kind of emotionally prepare.
Yeah, like what benefit are you looking for? So a lot of people want to really find out, did you actually love me? Did you love me? Did you want me? So we know now from stats that over half of us were either and or unloved or unwanted. So that's a lot. You know, you think every other person that you meet experiences themselves as unloved and or unwanted. And so I'm sure that the underlying is, did you ever really love me, or am I loved? Did you want me? And so that's one, I think, really one important question is, what are you most curious about? Like, to actually activate some curiosity so that, you know, you're not trying to just prove a point. Like, I knew that already, and now you've confirmed it. But for me, when I got curious about how my dad got through the Depression, because he did his growing up during the Great Depression. And so I said, well, and how did you manage? I mean, how did you ever, you know, make any money? He was getting ready to go to school. So he delivered newspapers for a penny a piece. And he saved up $300 of pennies to go off to college through his newspaper route. And I would never have known that. And if I hadn't really gotten curious about how was it for you? So I get really curious about how was it different back then than it is now? And, you know, what did you encounter? What obstacles? You know, what did you really like to do? So are you willing to treat your parent as another adult? So I think if people are willing, you know, you're the child, but you're also another human. And are you willing to see your parents as human? And so with everything that comes with that, the, you know, the foibles and the desires and the, you know, like, so what did you want to do? And did you get to do that? And, you know, those kinds of, you know, what were your adventures? What was the thing you most loved to do as a kid? And those kinds of things that are actually based on appreciation. I want to know what your experience was. And it was from that I found out that both of our parents, Gay and me, both of our parents had exactly the same experience with taking the $5 bill to buy the week's groceries and losing it. And it actually defined my mother's whole life. She was so freaked out. So she'd lost the week's groceries for the family, and she never found it, and she basically never got over it. And so she always got everything on sale. She wrote down every single thing that she spent. She had a little book where she'd write down and put, you know, spent 35 cents on, you know, gum and chips, and, you know, and it would always get, we'd get the bag of cookies that you could get 300 ginger snaps for $1.99, you know, but she would not treat herself because of that experience. So those kinds of things I would never have found out if I just thought, oh, they're my folks. They take care of me. I don't really care about their lives.
Right, right. Yeah, they're not just this kind of ambient force has cookies in the fridge.
Right, yeah. The cookie dispensers are the, you know, calling you in for supper, or, you know, right, giving you grief about what you're, you know, they're the policemen.
Right.
So if you can even for just a moment see them as humans, you know, with their own dreams and their own aspirations and their own things that were disappointments, it can immediately open a kind of richness. I'm remembering when I finally, because I've been a psychologist for many years now, and I would give lectures, and I remember in the middle of one of my lectures, my mother just blurted out, "You know, we really didn't want you." Because, you know, I'd always known that my brother, Bill, was always called number one. I'd always known that. But you'd think I would have been devastated by hearing that. But it was actually, to have the truth of my experience confirmed actually opened up the possibility for us to become friends after many, many years of...
Right. How much... So let's say that... someone, I think that is really the question that is the context for which many relationships are based is, did you really want me?
Yeah.
I think you put your finger right on it. If someone has the fear that their parents didn't want them.
Yeah.
How would you recommend, but they're still curious about their parents' life,
see,
right?
If like, if you are one of those people, mm-hmm. your body knows. Mm. So it's not, you know, the secret is pushing that down and not really letting that be aired out. You know, so when it, you know, it really was opening a window and letting, really letting sunshine in, like, oh, yes, I knew that. And then I was able to actually find my wholeness, because I always felt that split of, she says she wanted me, but there's always this kind of competitiveness and stuff going on. And it that was the moment where our relationship really shifted, where we were able to be adults together and appreciate each other and appreciate, like, we both love art. And you know, and I appreciate so much how she raised me. She was an artist and took art in school, and so I was raised with beauty, you know, and a sense of refinement and color and all around me. And to recognize that was at the core of what my mother really loved. That was her genius, and to be able to then appreciate that without any contamination really opened up so much more of a flow of connection between us. So I would say they already know, and what will drop away is that fog of, oh, I don't want to hear it, but you already know.
So would you as I'm kind of crafting this book and crafting mm-hmm. the ways in which you can interview your parents, obviously there are a million ways to do it, but one thing that I want to give people is the best possible chance of a good experience interviewing their parents. So one thing that I've been writing about is starting with something positive.
Absolutely.
And I have this whole chapter on, like, it's kind of goes to appreciation, really, but it's like tell me about something specific in mm-hmm. your life that you really like or that you did that's going to evoke a positive memory.
Yeah.
Because it kind of fills the reservoir to be able to cover a vaster territory.
I absolutely would recommend starting with appreciation, which is giving sensitive awareness to your parents' actual experience. And so that when I was, like, I was telling my dad, you even rode your bike in the snow? You'd get up at 4 a.m. to ride your bike in the snow for a penny, a paper? It was like, I was like, wow, your determination. And then I was, oh, well, I wonder if I got some of, because I have actually been called pretty stubborn, you know, because when I commit to something, I'm going to do it. And I think I might have gotten some of that from you. And there was this, you know, there was this sense of, oh, we share much more than just the, you know, you're the parent, you will do what I say. And, you know, and otherwise he was off working and I never saw him and I didn't know what he was doing.
Right. So when coming back to this, did you love me question?
Yeah.
That feels like risky territory to bring up in the interview.
Yeah. I wouldn't recommend that. Right. Well, see, the thing is, it's going to be there in the background, but just like any kind of relationship, you don't want to, you didn't love me, did you?
Right.
Yeah, you know, but there you go.
I don't expect dad to be talking about his newspaper route much after
that. Right. What I would start with is something that you are genuinely curious about their experience that you don't know about. And I would start with something really simple, just like, you know, what were your days like when you were in high school? Or, you know, what was your first job and how did you get it? And did you have a job? And
right. Great. And then getting into that kind of a question, would you recommend maybe an interview being a wedge to open conversations with a therapist down the road if they would be open to it?
Like, sure.
These are maybe two separate projects.
I agree. I think right. that the interview is really to establish a connection. And so you want to approach that with appreciation, not with secrets, but you're gonna save the top of the mountain for a little bit further along. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not gonna try and jump the mountain, but lay some groundwork. And the things that you genuinely appreciate, like, you know, my dad loved to cook. He would cook big flapjacks for us, you know, a whole pan, and he'd flip them. You know, we could have that for our Sunday dinner. It was very special to, you know, not have regular dinner, but be able to have breakfast for dinner. And so I would go, now, where did you learn your flapjack recipe? You know, because it, and there was a whole story that went with that, that, you know, and he learned it when he was in camp as a scout, and he was the one that could really flip him. Everybody else flipped him into the fire. And so it gave him this pleasant memory of his childhood and gave me more of a sense of his various skills that he brought to bear. He was an engineer, but he could bring that to the flapjacks too.
Right.
That kind of precision.
When it comes to seeing the world differently, I'm going to talk about this, or write about this more specifically in the book, but my relationship with my parents, I think a complex aspect of it is that we really see what's happening in the world through different lenses.
I think that's often the case.
Right. So we trust very different news sources. Mm-hmm. Something will happen halfway around the world and we will have
a completely different response.
Different story of what happened.
Yeah.
So it limits the conversation.
Yes.
Or it can. But I mean, my intention with this project and, you know, just personally with my own parents is like, I want to have as good of a relationship as is possible. Mm-hmm. And I think that there are ceilings on any relationship. I don't have any kind of Pollyannish ideas about that. But I wanted to ask, how would you recommend if someone had a relationship with their parents where they just saw the world very differently?
Yes.
Like, if it's worth even getting into that conversation?
I would say right now, no.
Okay.
I've been a activist since the 1960s, and my parents were Reagan Republicans. And so many of our conversations at home were just, you know, I just couldn't believe that they were going to vote for this guy. And, you know, those, and I could just tell it didn't make any difference what I said, because their experience came out of the Great Depression. And so they wanted to be safe and reliable and conservative, you know, and don't take big risks. And so that the experiences are going to shape your worldview. I don't actually know what we're going to do about our truth problem today, that we have completely different realities that people. So the thing that has always worked for me is to come to my actual experience. So the body sensations I'm noticing, the emotions that I'm experiencing or noticing, and the specific thoughts that I'm having. Like, I'm just having a thought, oh, this could get pretty dicey if we start to talk about this. Or I just feel I feel sad at the level of disconnection of people just simply not being able to be together. But I've made a huge practice. I have a group I'm working with right now that our job is to bridge. And so when I show up in the world, I lead with appreciation. and when I'm out in the world. I'll lead with something that I call unarguable. Like, boy, that fog really just, I thought I was going to get up and, you know, and just run out into the sun today, and I had to put a sweater on, and I noticed you have a sweater on too. So it's not profound, but it's a shared reality. So even though our politics, you know, or our world views may have gotten completely skewed, our physical presence and our experience as humans is very, very similar. And so if I can give reference to that, especially if I'm noticing something like, I will say like, that color really makes me smile. You know, and so I'm not, you know, asking them to do anything or to shift anything. I'm opening a space where we can actually be together, even if it's just for a moment. And that actually seems to be working. I've had, you know, like on this last road trip, I had wonderful, amazing experience with strangers. And I know that, you know, half of them have a completely different worldview. But in this moment, we have a shared reality.
One benefit of, that was great, by the way. One benefit of interviewing that you don't necessarily have in conversation, and I'm writing about this right now, is that you don't actually need to respond right to your parent. It might be kind of awkward if you're in conversation and they go on a tangent, and you just switch the subject.
Right.
But you actually have that permission in an interview to just
change the subject,
to just pause yep, and then move to a different subject. Mm-hmm. So let's say someone is interviewing their parents and they're consciously trying to navigate this terrain so that they don't hit, let's say, you know, the big tree right of politics or something. Yeah, they don't go head first into that, and their dad starts going down that trail and mm-hmm, it looks like they're heading for a tree. Mm-hmm. So one recommendation I have is that you don't actually need to respond.
Right.
You can switch the subject to yes, a different.
Now but that's difficult for a child.
Right.
You know, to not respond to a parent. So, but it's a really valuable, healthy shift to go. What I recommend for people is they either find their, or they move a little bit, because people freeze. They literally freeze their bodies. And so if they simply move a little bit, you know, wiggle a little bit or feel their feet, they get located in their own bodies. They can get out of the fear trance for that moment and just be present. And when somebody is breathing and presencing, that's very powerful. We think it's not powerful because I'm not saying those words, but I've seen a whole meeting change by the presence of someone who was breathing and being there and just giving attention. It was like looking at different people and breathing. She was creating that openness for people to be together. So those kinds of nonverbal skills are incredibly powerful. So what you're calling the pause, most people, if you'll notice in conversation, hardly anybody can actually pause. Like, you know, because that's airtime. Yeah. <You know? laughs> But if I'm pausing, it allows things to settle. It allows us to find a rhythm rather than that. So the some things have to just emerge. You know, they're not right there. Like my parents were so different. My dad, when he was moving, was like a yacht coming into harbor. He was so slow and incredibly introverted. I remember once asking him a question about math, and I actually timed him. He went inside, and he kind of rolls his eyes back and goes, and he would make noises, and he didn't answer me for 2 minutes. He was that introverted. So, but my mother was like a demented hummingbird. She was like all over the place. And so I learned that it was really important for me to come back home to myself, because otherwise I'd be careening around with my mother, or I would be just kind of going to sleep with my dad. And a person finding their own, I'm okay here by myself, and I can affirm my own presence regardless of what my parent is doing. Boy, that creates freedom. And if you only have one experience of that, that's an opening that you can build on.
Right. So you would recommend, if it starts going into uncomfortable territory, to pause, do a...
Or just stand up.
Yeah.
Move around a little bit.
Yeah. Okay. And then sit down, and then you can move to a different subject more. Yeah. That's your off ramp.
Yep.
Okay.
And I actually, when people are going to visit their parents, you know, when I used to do therapy with people, I would have them plan their off ramps. Because, you know, we actually say that families are the Olympics of communication. You need to practice. You know, practice with people you know love you. And, you know, you practice your listening skills, practice difficult conversations. But with your folks, like when my parents got more advanced in age, I would plan, like if I wanted to spend time with them, I would do it in a place, like I would invite my mother to go to an art exhibit, or we would go for a walk on the beach. So we were doing something together rather than simply sitting and talking, because we could then enjoy the environment where we were and not have it all depend on the quality of our conversation. We could have pauses, but we were both doing, we were doing something that we both enjoyed. But like if at a, you know, Thanksgiving or a family dinner, I would say, okay, where are you, if you can't stay there, where are you going to go? You know, and how long, and what are the signals that it's time for you to leave? Because most people will hang in there until they're just flattened, you know, or until there's been a big uproar and somebody, you know, leaves in a huff, which is dangerous, you know, for you and for everybody else in traffic. And so I think off-ramps, planning your off-ramps, planning your breaks, and giving yourself permission to leave. I mean, most kids have not ever done that. They just hang in there until they're bloodied.
Right. So one thing that I wanted to ask you about is post-interview.
Yeah.
Navigating that kind of energy. I think that is really good advice on how to steer clear of difficult topics so that it can be a good experience overall. I think that's really wise. As you said, like the parents are the it's the Olympics of communication.
Yeah.
And even if it goes well, it could feel like you need to go scream into the wind.
Yeah, you're going to have residue
for a day straight.
Absolutely. In fact, one of the things that I always recommend is go for a walk or put on music and dance like crazy. You know, and if you have the opportunity, like, you know, if you can make noise in water, you can, you know, like put your head underwater and,
right.
You know, and just let it all. And or if you go for a walk with a friend and you can just, because you'll be unpacking it while you're walking. Don't sit and talk, because that just keeps it in your head. But if you're moving in some way and sharing with somebody else, it'll allow you to download probably something you go, oh, it'll allow you to download a connection. Oh, that's why he always treated me like that when I was in high school. Oh, that's why he always looked so sad. Oh, and that kind of connection is just invaluable. And it's also like, even if you've done really well in an exam, you can have that post-exam letdown because you've been running a little bit on adrenaline. So you're also moving that adrenaline through you. Yeah. So you're metabolizing it rather than spewing it on other people.
Right. Yeah. Post-exam adrenaline. I know that one. That's really funny. I just finished the exam. I feel like I need to take another exam right now.
Right.
That's all I can do.
Or it's like, I took the exam and so what?
Right.
You know, that kind of,
the comedian's depression, the post, post performance.
You give a great performance and then you go out and kill yourself.
Right.
Yeah.
As I've been writing more and more, about just this subject, a lot of, and I'm kind of looking back at my own childhood, and a lot of stories are coming up. A lot of them are fun stories, and a lot of them are harder stories. But one theme that I am kind of coming to terms with is my own petulance and kind of shittiness to my parents.
Oh.
Growing up, I think that just before we become adults, we don't, and even maybe when we do become adults, we might not realize how we can hurt our parents just as our parents can hurt us.
Yeah. Well, we all use the tools at our disposal.
Right.
And it sounded like one of yours was kind of being a bit of an asshole.
Yeah. I think that there's maybe a, there was a belief that parents will just, they'll just always be there and they'll love you no matter how much of a punching bag you make them.
Yeah.
And I think that it's important to just recognize that we probably all have some stories like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to ask about apology and or just navigating that kind of stuff.
It happened.
Right.
So you're like apologizing for being. You know, and that's not a very good setup for, mm-hmm. you know, continuing to expand your life as a thriving human. But you could talk about, oh, I feel sad when I realize how much I just pushed you guys and just was so irresponsible. And I remember that time you were really scared that I wasn't going to be coming home. And I just waltzed in and said, well, you know, I'm in charge of my own life, yeah, and you stop bossing me around. So the actual, particularly the emotions, like I realized that you were scared, and I didn't know you were scared. I thought you were just being picky, or you know, the getting more of a clarity that we all share the same emotions, and you know, like I have all my life been able to see people's feelings and see people's energy, and so. When I was very young, I could tell when my parents were upset, but I was a kid. And so you want to hear how you are from a kid? You know, something like, and so I could feel it, but I wouldn't say it. And so that made me much more withheld and quieter than my brothers, who just, you know, raised hell and did whatever they wanted to. Also, that was because they were the boys. Right. So we have that whole cultural thing to deal with. But when I was able to see that my mother's behavior came from her experience as a kid and what she experienced with her parent, that generational lineage and learning about that lineage was so valuable to me. In fact, I have a picture in the hall that I'll show you that is of four generations of my mother as a baby being held by her mother with her mother standing next to her and her mother.
Wow.
So four generations in one picture. And I can see the theme throughout the whole lineage. So it's not just you, it's right, your, what did all of your ancestors have to deal with in order for you to be here now? And that appreciation, I think, just gives us more of a, more texture, more of a weave, rather than the, just the bam, 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 you know, of a ping pong game that's based on intellectual understanding. I think that if I can give my parents that the emotional space to be recognized, the challenges, the things that were disappointments, the triumphs, and that emotional space is the ticket to making a deeper connection. Not who did what when, but, oh, God, that must have been really hard. I really did not appreciate how much you did. Like one of the things, my mother could do so much with not very much money, you know, and her ingenuity, you know, I could really appreciate and let her know I appreciate it. And then the hard edges begin to soften.
Right. That was wonderful. Anything else pertaining to this project?
Yes. What was just coming to me is do some journaling before you do your interview. And also, you can take it into your dream. So like if any of you like to do dream work, you can imagine, what would be the most interesting, the most valuable things for me to ask about? Or what would I really like to know about that I didn't even know that I want to know about? And then let that come to you both through, you know, through journaling, which I think is really valuable, or drawing, or singing, or moving, so that you're kind of priming the pump, and letting your what we call your unconscious, but it's really your deeper consciousness to come more to the surface rather than your social consciousness. Because the times when I've been able to, my parents aren't here any longer, but the times that I was able to be with them, just simply be with them, are those are the things that I remember, and those are the things I know made the most difference to them. You know, not the things that I accomplished, or the accolades that I gave to them, or the parties that we created for them, but was this the being together? Because that's that sense of connection is truly what we all long for.
Great place to end. Where can people stay in touch with you and follow your work?
Well, we have so many social media avenues now. We have two websites. We have one that's called Hendricks.com, and that's H-E-N-D-R-I-C-K-S, not X. And that's where you can find out about a lot of our relationship work and our seminars, where we teach other people how to do conscious loving relationship work and body intelligence work, which is big time fun. And then our foundation for consciousliving.org, that's a long title, but that's our nonprofit foundation. And we have literally dozens of videos, of handouts, of outlines about three things: how to come home to yourself, how to restore resourcefulness, and how to create caring communities. So if you're feeling, you know, wiped out, or you're feeling really scared, there are resources. We have free seminars that people can attend. Really want people to experience being loved, wanted, and appreciated. And so that's what we're up to.
Katie Hendricks, thank you so much.
Thank you. And it's a wrap.
It's a wrap. That's our show. Before you head off into your day, you can go to tierman.substack.com to get my newsletter, my articles, thoughts, ramblings. If you want to hear more from me, tierman.substack.com is the place to be. That's it for now. Thank you so much for tuning in. Get out in the water, whatever body of water is closest to you, lake, river, bathtub, or ocean. I promise it will make your day better. See you soon.